So the Theragata, the voices of the first Buddhist women, there is a collection that Susan Murcott wrote, first published in 1991, called The First Buddhist Women, Translations and Commentary on the Theragata. And since then, you'll find articles and other books and various other resources, and certainly now you can find many things on the internet. In 1991, you couldn't do that. So if you want to look into some of those verses, and I just want to share a little bit of those first early women's voices. Many of these women were from the royalty class, and in fact, the first nuns in the Buddhist order were, many of them were the wives, mothers, or daughters of the first monks, including, of course, the Buddha, whose stepmother was the leader of the first group of nuns. So, and many of these, as did the Buddha, came from the wealthiest class and sought ordination as nuns. Some of their stories are, again, a voice that you can believe. Sometimes, you know, those of us who renounce in certain ways, certain aspects of life, the voice isn't maybe quite as believable as someone like a Buddha or the Buddha's stepmother, who was a queen, a princess, so forth, the Buddha, a prince, who has already experienced absolutely everything that the world has to offer at their particular time, and then chooses a life of renunciation. There's a bit of a truth to that voice when that voice is telling one to let go of worldly things, that worldly things do not bring happiness. When someone has in fact lived in palaces their entire life, you just listen a bit more carefully. And then there are also the women, and of course the men in the monastic order, who came from deep grief and sorrow also to the tradition. And so out of their suffering, we hear the voice of suffering, and we hear also their, again, really believable statements of how the path of practice helps heal and console from situations that seem non-consolable. So Vasetti was a woman who was happily married and then had a son, and then her son died, and she went mad, just completely mad, and until she encountered the Buddha, who just with a word really called her back to her sanity, to her equanimity. And of course, she joined the nun's order and became a fully realized arhant. Grief-stricken for my son, mad-minded, out of my senses, I was naked with wild hair and I wandered anywhere. I lived on trash heaps in a graveyard and by the highways. 3 years wandering, starved and thirsty. And then in the city of Mithila, I saw the one who tames what is untamed and goes his way in happiness, enlightened and unafraid. I came to my senses, paid homage, and sat down. Out of compassion, Gautama Buddha taught me the way. When I heard his words, I set out into homelessness. By putting his teachings into practice, I realized great joy. My grief is cut out, finished, ended. For I have understood the ground from which all grief comes. They called, most of you probably know, when you went to follow the Buddha as a monastic, going forth into the homeless life. So letting go of all homes and wandering with the Buddha. Vimala was a prostitute. She became a nun. Murcott comments, in the fourth stanza of her poem, Vimala says, I, my same self. This detail suggests that she has not rejected the person she once was, but instead is affirming a continuity in her life. From this point of view, the line, I have cut men and gods out of my life, instead of implying that she has built an impenetrable wall around herself, shows rather that she is no longer ruled by inside images or outside forces. So that's a lovely comment on the kind of release that our practice can bring to us, a liberation from inside images and outside forces. And of course, that speaks to the situation of anyone, the condition of women in a culture or the condition of social status for men or women, the liberation from inside images and outside forces. So this is Vimala's voice. Young, intoxicated by my own lovely skin, my figure, my gorgeous looks, and famous, too. I despised other women. Dressed to kill at the whorehouse door, I was a hunter and spread my snare for fools. And when I stripped for them, I was the woman of their dreams. I laughed as I teased them. Today, head shaved, robed, alms wanderer, I, my same self, sit at the tree's foot, no thought. All ties untied, I have cut men and gods out of my life. I have quenched the fires. So that's a lovely verse of how the path of practice and the journey to enlightenment quenches the fire of desire and passion. So we see the healing of grief, moving beyond grief, the quenching of passion and desire. And then how certain aspects of the wandering life appeal to the early Buddhist women. This is Buddha Bada, Kundalakesha. Pronunciation, I'm sorry. I cut my hair and wore the dust, and I wandered in my one robe. Finding fault where there was none, and finding no fault where there was. Then I came from my rest one day at Vulture Peak and saw the pure Buddha with his monks. I bent my knee, paid homage, pressed my palms together. We were face to face. Come, Bada, he said. That was my ordination. I have wandered throughout Anga and Magadha, Aji, Kasi, and Kosala, 55 years with no debt. I have enjoyed the alms of these kingdoms. A wise lay follower gained a lot of merit. He gave a robe to Bada, who is free from all bonds. I like that this happens a lot in all the Buddhist poetry and verses, as you know. There's a surface story and a subtext. So in the surface, she tells her ordinary story of her ordinary life, but within, kind of between the lines, and particularly, of course, at the end, she says, a wise lay follower gained a lot of merit. He gave a robe to Bada, who is free from all bonds. She implies this enlightenment, really, arhatship, both by the fact that someone giving her a robe would gain a lot of merit, and just by saying that she's free from all bonds. She has no debt at all. So there's an ordinary interpretation of that, and then a quite extraordinary meaning to that as well. There was a nun, Patachara, who shows up in a lot of different verses of other nuns. Apparently, she was a very strong woman and gave a lot of help and support to many of the other nuns. There was a lot of leadership that she gave, a lot of comfort. So we see her referred to quite often. So this is Kanda, the nun Kanda speaking. I met a nun who had her own food and drink. She was Patachara. She guided me in leaving home and encouraged me and urged me to the highest good. Again, this is a simple verse, but the implication there is the entire path. Her nun friend took her in and guided her to the very end of the path, the highest good. Another line was found, I went to a nun I thought I could trust. We see just in these little pieces that have come down to us the feeling among the early nuns. She pulled out the arrow hidden in my heart. This is Patachara's voice herself. When they plow their fields and sow seeds in the earth, when they care for their wives and children, young Brahmins find riches. But I've done everything right and followed the rule of my teacher. I'm not lazy or proud. Why haven't I found peace? So those first two verses tell us that she spent a lot of time in struggle on her path. Then came these final verses. Bathing my feet, I watch the bathwater spill down the slope. I concentrate my mind the way you train a good horse. Then I took a lamp and went into my cell, checked the bed, and sat down on it. I took a needle and pushed the wick down. When the lamp went out, my mind was freed. This, again, a lot of the verses, these simple activities which imply, first, again, the early verses, years, months, years of incredible effort. And we know that, the practice. And then stories of how suddenly, after putting in all that practice, one in an ordinary moment relaxes, does some ordinary things, but with a mountain of mindfulness built up from all that effort. And in that relaxing, the mind is freed. I always love the story of Ananda, you know, which is Buddha's trusty sidekick, Ananda, who had this photographic memory and so remembered every word of the Buddhas and made some progress, but actually was not a fully enlightened arhat at the time of the Buddha's death. But I particularly love him because actually he, according to the legend, was the one who interceded on the women's behalf. And when the Buddha was not quite ready to ordain the women, asked the Buddha a series of questions which he had to reply in the affirmative about women's capability for enlightenment. And then finally, sort of with a lot of nerve, I thought, gave the punchline, which is basically, so why don't you ordain these women who are asking for ordination? So he did. So under Sweet Ananda, later, so the Buddha dies, and they are wanting to have a convocation of all the enlightened arhats to decide what the Buddha said and didn't say and so forth. And they'd really like Ananda to be there, but he's not a fully ordained arhat, so he can't come. So there's a lot of pressure saying, Ananda, you know, you have to get fully enlightened before this meeting. So a lot of pressure, and he sits and he walks and he sits and he walks. And, in the tradition, it's always said that you learn mindfulness sitting, standing, walking and lying down. But then people will always ask, well, can you get enlightened in any other than those four postures? You know, the traditions you can get enlightened sitting or standing or walking or lying down. And then the story is, well, actually there's Ananda because he, you know, under this pressure, he's sitting, he's standing, he's walking, he's sitting, he's standing, he's walking. He finally just gives up and decides to go to bed. And on the way from sitting on the bed to lying, he becomes fully enlightened. So you can also do it in the middle between one or the other. So this tremendous pressure and effort and pressure and effort. And then also to relax. Because while the pressure and the effort does help us make certain progress, you cannot actually become fully enlightened without the openness of relaxing. Ajahn Mun, the great 19th century Thai master, said nirvana is the ultimate ease. So we must relax. And so we see this in the verses of the women and in the other teachings as well, the effort, but then also the letting go or the relaxing. Or in her case, she just reached over to put out the light to go to bed. And then in the next moment was completely freed. So there are lovely verses and stories. They're just so sweet. Here's Kanda. I was in a bad way. A widow, no children, no friends, no relations to give me food and clothes. I was a beggar with a bowl and stick, and wandered house to house in the heat and cold for 7 years. But I met a nun who had food and drink. We know who that was. And I went up to her and said, take me into the homeless life. She was Padachara. Out of pity, she guided me in leaving home, encouraged me to the highest good. I took her advice. It wasn't wasted. I have the three knowledges. There are no obsessions in my mind. Wonderful thing to say. The three knowledges, the knowledge of anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and the emptiness of self. So the early Buddhist nuns, there are a lot of resources and you can read more of them. Then in so many different Buddhist countries, and in our modern times, of course, there are voices of Buddhist women. So I'd like to just share a few from a few places. Chinese, in China, the beginning of Chan Buddhism, which later became Zen. And between the 6th and the 3rd century BCE, there was a famous woman poet, Buddhist poet. This just a short verse, but also to mention that often in the Chinese and Japanese tradition, the mention of moonlight, the hazy moon of enlightenment, is actually a metaphor for enlightenment itself. So when you're reading these verses, women, the men, in the Chinese and the Japanese poets, mention of moonlight is about the light of enlightenment itself, light in the darkness. At night, I could not sleep because of the moonlight on my bed. I kept hearing a voice calling. Out of nowhere, nothing answered. Yes. So this is in deep retreat, obviously. All night I could not sleep because of the moonlight on my bed. I kept hearing a voice calling. Out of nowhere, nothing answered. Yes. In the 8th century, there was a princess of northern India who was betrothed to the king of Sri Lanka and thus was introduced to tantric Buddhist practice. Her name was Lakshminkara. And I didn't bring the dohas. They're a beautiful tradition of ecstatic songs spontaneously sung out again in enlightenment. But I did bring a little bit of one of her verses, which it's a little bit wacky, the tantric tradition, just a little strange, a little, think of cutting through of logic, discursiveness, conceptuality, the whole linear realm. And you get a feel for what some of these tantric dohas were like. Lay your head on a block of butter and chop. Break the blade of the axe. The woodcutter laughs. A frog swallows an elephant. It's amazing, Makala, do not doubt. If it confounds you, O seeker, drop concepts now. My teacher didn't tell me. I didn't understand. Flowers blossomed in the sky. It's marvelous, Makala. Have no doubt. If you're incredulous, adept, drop your doubts. A barren woman gives birth. A chair dances. Because cotton is expensive, the naked weep. Amazing, an elephant sits on a throne held up by two bees. Incredible, the sightless lead. The mute speak. Amazing. A mouse chases a cat. An elephant flees from a crazy donkey. It's marvelous, Makala. Do not doubt. If you're stunned, adept, drop your doubts. Amazing. A hungry monkey eats rocks. Wonderful, the experience of the mind. Who can express it? So in the literature, you find a lot of these wild, crazy dohas of illogic and celebration of stepping out of the ordinary reality. And then I want to mention Izumi Shikibu, considered one of the greatest women, greatest poets in Japanese literature. Again, the moon. I cannot say which is which. The glowing plum blossom is the spring night's moon. Watching the moon at midnight, solitary, mid-sky, I knew myself completely, no part left out. Clearly, again, that's an enlightenment verse. Although the wind blows terribly here, the moonlight also leaks between the roof planks of this ruined house. Although the wind blows terribly here, the moonlight also leaks between the roof planks of this ruined house. Actually, that's an old age verse. The aches and pains of this ruined house, and yet the moonlight still shows up. And then this is the, Izumi Shikibu's verse of how even in retreat and on the path, we also need to hear and listen to the call of the suffering in of people and the situations in ordinary life. Although I try to hold the single thought of Buddhist teaching in my heart, I cannot help but hear the many crickets' voices calling as well. So that again in Japanese, the crickets' voices is the outside world, the ordinary world, the regular folks. So that answering, Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion who became Kuan Yin in China and Japan, the female energy of hearing the cries of the world. Kuan Yin is often called the cry regarder. She who hears the suffering, hears the cries of the world and comes. So that sense of both walking the path and accomplishing the hazy moon of enlightenment in retreat, and yet hearing the suffering and responding to the cries of the world shows up so often in the story of women's spiritual poetry. The Vietnamese tradition and the Korean tradition actually had a long lineage of, over the centuries, of women masters who were actually mentioned in their history, probably Korea the most. So there were some Buddhist countries where there were, of course, in all the countries, women masters, but some who the public mention of them in the lineage and the list of the ancestors was not as problematic as in some other of the cultures. The earliest woman writer of Vietnam was the daughter of a prince and the goddaughter of a king. And then when she became widowed, she became a nudist, a Buddhist, not a nudist. She became a Buddhist nun and was the director of a temple. Birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the beginning, this is the way things have always been. Any thought of release in this life will wrap you only more tightly in its snares. The sleeping person looks for a Buddha. The troubled person turns toward meditation. But the one who knows that there's nothing to seek knows too that there's nothing to say. She keeps her mouth closed. So it may seem a little bit like a put down, but it's actually an outline of the stages on the path where we all go, looking for a Buddha, then trouble turning toward meditation, but then finally on the accomplishment end of things, when one realizes that there's nothing to seek, one also realizes that there's nothing to say. And often it is the case that we hear in the tradition of monastics going into just complete silence for the last 10 or 20 years of their lives, both men and women, just that sense of, or at least silence from the point of view of the ordinary world. In the more modern era, there's a Korean woman, Sub-ok, 1902 to 1966. She left home at age 16, secretly, and she sought ordination but was turned down at temples that didn't accept women, and then finally found a temple and ordained as a Buddhist nun. And She became very respected. She studied with various teachers then actually trained in the monks' colleges in Korea. So just a little verse from her. Spring at Yesan Station. The steam whistle cleaves to the wind as the train speeds over 1,000 mountains. White clouds hang leisurely in the sky over the station, bidding farewell. The spring breeze spins a humming song in the branches of a green willow at the crossroads, waving its cane as it returns, chanting alone. Again, it seems like a very ordinary description. And yet, actually, the subtext there is that she is she's speaking to this stage in practice when all sound becomes the sound of mantra in one's perception. So it's a very sweet, very beautiful verse. I better move along here. I've got a lot. You can read, though, in some resources. Sister Chan Kong, Vietnamese Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh's first student, beautiful book called, her name translates as Sister True Emptiness. She was first Sister Phong. There's a lovely book, Learning True Love, How I Learned and Practiced Social Change in Vietnam. So I'll just refer you to that resource for a beautiful modern voice. And, of course, many of you know the teaching Pema Chodron and a wonderful Western women modern voice of Tibetan Buddhist practice. Tell you a little about the Sokni nuns. In the time I have left, my teacher, Sokni Rinpoche III, let me just read you a personal letter from Sokni Rinpoche. He's the third. So the first Sokni Rinpoche began the tradition of the Nang Cheng nuns. This is in Eastern Kham in Tibet, more than a century ago. Because of the devastation of the Cultural Revolution, I thought they were gone, and I was sad that I hadn't spent time with them. Then, when I visited Tibet, I realized that through the kindness and great effort of the older nuns, this tradition was kept alive and is now taking root again with a new generation of young women. But they need our support. I decided to take on the responsibility of preserving this tradition. Then these accomplished women practitioners can join me in teaching in the West. These women embody the full richness of Buddhist love, compassion, and wisdom in female form. It is quite rare, I think. If this light of tradition is gone from this earth, even though we have texts, the experiential warmth and blessing of this living women's Buddhist tradition is gone forever. So these nuns were in Eastern Kham before the Cultural Revolution, and there are, you know, about 4,000 of them or so right now. They were supported by their families in the villages, and then the chaos of the Cultural Revolution. And when you see photographs now of these nuns, there's actually, you see a lot of young women, and you see a lot of very old women. And all of my age group and the age group of most of the women here is missing in the photographs because, of course, those were the women that were killed or imprisoned in the Cultural Revolution. But the older nuns, who are quite old now, and there's only a few of them left, hid in and continued their practice in the caves, and people hid them and so forth. And then they've emerged now, and a huge number of very young nuns have come and more are coming wanting to take the teachings. And Sokhne Rinpoche and his teacher Adi Rinpoche are trying to transmit to the older nuns the teaching, the older nuns to the younger nuns. These nuns are actually famous in Kham for being very, very highly, highly realized women practitioners. And men and women come to study with them, but there aren't so many of the young, the older ones left. The young ones are trying to learn as fast as they can and as practiced as they can, but this middle generation is missing. And what's also missing is the family and societal support that used to be there. So Sokhne Rinpoche, as the third Sokhne, has connected them with us in the West and started an endowment fund for them, because he says, if I die tomorrow, they have nothing. Excuse me. So they need the help of those in the West to survive. They live on so little. It's really something. And yet they carry with tremendous courage this tradition of really dedicated and deep, deep practice. They do some of these wild practices that I only heard of in books, you know, the tummo practice, where you put you're just dressed in the equivalent of a bathing suit, and you put, you know, a soaked cloth and walk in meditation in the freezing cold of these high elevations and dry the cloth, you know, from the heat of the practice, and various amazing practices like that that still exist in these small gatherings of little pieces of nunnery here and there. So that's the voice, the current voice that I'm hearing in terms of the voices of women in Buddhism, and the excitement of reaching across the world to help save these nuns. Of course, you know here of the organization that has been supporting the Tibetan Nuns in Exile, the Tibetan Nuns Project, because it's headquartered in Seattle, and since in the late 80s, early 90s, has been helping in so many ways, financial and otherwise, the Tibetan Nuns in Exile. And that I think you have flyers out there for that, those women. And so there is a continued support of the nuns, the Tibetan nuns, trying to survive and trying to be reborn post-cultural revolution times. And so if you're moved for more information, there's there's a sheet with information there, and there's also a place to donate, and there's information on the sheet to donate or to share with others this story, and also just to internally connect with them. Every morning they pray for their Western supporters, and we can connect with their amazing practice. They dedicate their lives, some of these older nuns from age 7 and 10, an entire life of intensive practice. Quite wonderful stories. Here's a couple of actual stories, or maybe just one or two, from the Tibetan Nuns Project. I was only 7 years old, but I still remember the day I became a nun. I was so excited. There were no cars in Tibet in 1936, so my mother and I went by horse to see the nunnery. We did a divination to determine that I should enter Gari, one of the three main nunneries in Lhasa. As is the custom among the wealthy, my family sponsored a 3-day ceremony to celebrate my initiation into the community. My mother and I awoke in the early morning, ate barley flour porridge, and offered sweet rice with butter to the nuns. These foods, considered highly auspicious, are eaten for good luck. Huge pots of our traditional Tibetan salt and butter tea were served throughout the day as the nuns sat to pray for my auspicious beginnings as a nun. My mother and I also offered money to the nuns and white scarves called kata to the teachers. Relatives and other noble families arrived to place kata on my shoulders and make small offerings. In my new way of life, this was all I would need. Robes, clothes, alms bowls, bricks of tea, and a small amount of money. I would take my vows in the coming days. There is a saying in Tibetan, it's rare to see a nun with gray hair. Now more than 60 years have passed since that auspicious morning of Sampa porridge. My hair is gray, my skin is brown and wrinkled, but I still am and will always be a nun. Very sweet. I'm running out of time here, so I can't share. There are also some really heart-rending stories of the nuns surviving cultural revolution and torture in prison and so forth, and still this strong commitment to continue the path. It's also very exciting to me that some of these nuns, Sophni Rinpoche has really the plan and the intention to bring them to the West to help him teach in the West. A beautiful, beautiful thing as well. There are so many modern voices now of Western women in Buddhism, and some of you may even be part of those voices here if you're poets and writers of Buddhism. It's a very exciting time for women and for men practitioners. And I am so filled with gratitude for the teaching, for this path, for all the women and men in the West as well as in Asia who have dedicated their lives to practice, to sharing, to helping, to supporting the survival of this tradition, and just hold us all up on this path of practice so that we can proceed. There's nothing to say really other than to be so full of gratitude. The path is about suffering and the end of suffering, and I know in my life's own experience that that's true. A life with a lot of suffering, and over the years, this path of practice has allowed me to let go of so much of that burden of suffering. I'm just so, so grateful. And I know we all are for the support and the gift of this practice and this path. And all the women and men through the decades and the centuries who have endured a lot, both internally and externally, to keep the path alive so that we could touch it and be transformed by it. So I'll close with a little poem again by Izumi Shikibu, which feels to me like just a soft, quiet prayer. The way I must enter leads through darkness to darkness. O moon above the mountain's rim, please shine a little further on my path. Thank you all for listening. Thank you.